Welcome to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak.
I'm Nell Larson.
And joining us on the phone is our first guest, Dr. Kurt Stager. He's a professor of natural sciences at Paul Smith's College up in the hinterlands of the Adirondacks of New York.
That's right. Best place on earth.
Your home, your hometown.
That's right.
Right? Maybe you're near Paul Smith's College.
Couple hours away. Adirondacks is a big place.
It's a big place. And it's a great place, too. And Dr. Stager is, a professor of natural sciences at Paul Smith's College. And among other things, he's got a new book coming out, Still Waters, The Secret World of Lakes. He also wrote an interesting op-ed in the New York Times about the declining populations of insects and the declining populations of naturalists like Professor Stager, who help oversee or study the natural world. Dr. Stager, thank you for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
Yeah, glad to be with you.
So let's start off with some information about yourself. You're a naturalist, a natural scientist, professor there at Paul Smith's College. What motivated you to get into the environmental field?
Well, I think, like a lot of people like me, it started at an early age and always had a passion for the outdoors that my parents nurtured. And as I got older, I just never grew out of it. So it's been a lifelong passion, and I feel privileged to have been able to make a living at it, too.
Right. And so now you're a professor there at Paul Smith's College, studying specifically lakes and lake biology. Talk a little bit about what that involves.
Sure. Up here in the Adirondacks, we have 3,000 lakes and ponds around us here, so it's a living laboratory and a great place to teach about ecology and our connections to the natural world. So in addition to doing things like studying what lives in the lakes now, from the fish to the plankton, my great passion is also to look deeper into the ecosystems and deeper into time by looking at the sediments under the lakes, because they also record the environmental history with the tiny little microscopic fossils of living things that are preserved going back thousands of years. So it gives you a long-term perspective on current environmental issues.
Well, actually, you wrote a piece I think it was for the New York Times Review of Books or so a couple months back when you looked at Walden Pond and the muck in Walden Pond and the story it tells.
The muck, a very technical term.
That's yeah.
Right. Yeah. Well, we use techniques that we've been sort of doing here in the Adirondacks, but when you draw your attention to one of the most famous lakes in the world because of Henry David Thoreau, who lived there in the 1800s, it really adds not only a new meaning, because it sort of has that thorough context in our culture, but it attracts a lot more attention, so it's a great teaching vehicle as well for how we're basically loving our lakes to death. And Walden Pond, as I explain in the first chapter of the book, is a prime example of that.
How has Walden Pond changed over the decades and centuries?
Well, you can actually see it preserved in the lakes. They not only reflect our impacts on the lake today, but they record what we do to it. And so going back to the time of Thoreau, if you could dive to the bottom of the lake, which sometimes people do, and you plunge your hand down to the wrist into the mud, your fingertips will touch the layers of sediment that were deposited when Thoreau was there. And if you take a little smear of that and look under a microscope, which is what I do, you can find the remains of plankton that were living in the lake that tell you that the lake was very, very clear and clean, and also pollen from the vegetation and things that have also changed. But what we see in the younger layers, which are on top of that, is the plankton has changed during the last century, showing that the lake has begun to lose a lot of its gem-like clarity that Thoreau had noted, and of course has to do with our impacts on the lake.
And what would those impacts include? Can you kind of check them off?
Yeah. Well, as the lake became more popular and Boston got more developed and more auto traffic, people could leave the city and come to places like Walden Pond in the hot summer day to go swimming. There was shoreline development around the pond. So there's a public swimming beach that was established on one end of the lake, and then trails and things were causing erosion of sediment, which can actually change the plankton. But oddly enough, maybe not so oddly, considering that we're a part of nature here, we share the same elements of life as all life. And so when we eat our food and then excrete our waste, those same atoms can be reused by plankton in a lake if we happen to pee in the lake while we're swimming, let's say.
Right.
So with hundreds of thousands of people visiting Walden to go swimming in the summer, a certain percentage of them will, you know, do what they're not supposed to do and basically pee in the lake rather than go to the bathroom. And a recent study by the U.S. Geological Survey calculated that about half of the summer phosphorus budget of the entire lake is now from human pee from the swimmers.
What?
Wow.
So talk about being a connection to nature there. There's a pretty elemental one. We are now embedded in the lake ecosystem and are changing it as a result.
And of course, you can extrapolate that out to other just lakes in general with public access. But in addition, you have perhaps farming operations that introduce both nitrogen and phosphorus and potassium, and pesticides and herbicides are having effect on lake biology. And back in the 70s, acid rain was a big deal, and acid rain was affecting many lakes in the Adirondacks, right? That seemed to be the go-to example of fish populations in the Adirondacks being affected by acid rain and lowering pH levels in lakes. Is that still an issue in the Adirondacks?
Well, that's another topic I discussed in the book. It's an untold success story, actually.
Right.
How science was used to show that we are acidifying the lakes, and it's coming from fossil fuel emissions. Basically, the sulfur and nitrogen in the acids came from burning coal and oil in factories and cars and things like that. And we, being downwind of the whole country, were getting the brunt of that air pollution. So federal legislation passed amendments to the Clean Air Act some decades ago, reduced the emissions, and a lot of the lakes are beginning to recover. It's just that we haven't heard that success story, we're really on the right path. And basically, a bipartisan cap-and-trade program, much like we're talking about with fossil fuels and global warming now, actually was put into place, and it worked. And it didn't ruin the economy and didn't shut down, you know, the power companies or anything like that. And we can actually see a beginnings of a reversal of the acidification here in the Adirondack Lakes. Hmm.
The book that we're talking about, The Secret World of Lakes, Still Waters, you just released this on May 29th. What was your motivation for writing this book?
It was partly a labor of love. I've been working on lakes professionally for 30-something years and traveled around the world and really got a sense that lakes are a really important, not only a reflection of our place in the world, but also windows on how we're connected to the natural world. And so I thought, why not just compile the backstories, the human backstories and the ecological backstories of the most iconic lakes in the world, which, of course, being a lake lover, I visited and studied a lot of them too, and so have a personal anecdotes, and used it to basically show how powerful a force of nature we've become in ways that are changing the lakes of the world and also recorded for all time in the sediments beneath them.
And as you kind of referenced, this book isn't a scientific tome. It's more of a story? Or how would you classify it?
Yeah, I guess I was bold enough in the introduction of the book to say I feel like I'm trying to update Thoreau's Walden book to have it more relevant to the 21st century, because when Thoreau was writing, he was heavily influenced by other philosophers who kind of saw humans as separate from nature. But a lot of people don't realize what a great scientist he was as well. He was the first one to map the bottom of an American lake. He measured the temperature differences and ecology of the lake, kept great detailed nature journals. But this was 150 years ago, and we've now had modern science to really show how intimately connected on elemental and ecological levels we are to the natural world. So I'd sort of like to take the feel of Thoreau's writing and imagine how excited he would have been to see how much deeper now we can dive into the stories of lakes. So I'm trying to sort of add on to what Thoreau did with Walden.
We're speaking with Dr. Kurt Stager. He's a professor of natural sciences at Paul Smith's College, author of the book Still Waters, The Secret World of Lakes. What was the most interesting or fascinating lake that you visited? Maybe one that's most at risk, too.
Oh, gosh. Well, actually, Walden's right up there. Yeah. I had never been to it before, and so I visited it the first time, sort of planning to do this, and also as part of my research, and I basically fell in love with a book. I hadn't remembered my, you know, personal connection to it through the Thoreau stories, which a lot of us around the world have. So basically what I was telling you about Walden is right up there, but there's some others too. I put in lakes of the Holy Land, the Sea of Galilee, for example, which despite the name is actually a lake.
Ah.
And I did work there before, and it's a freshwater lake. And the sediment records there under the lakes of the Holy Land go way, way, way back, earlier than the oldest scrolls, right? So
wow.
I was saying, well, heck, what does it tell you about some of the great stories of the biblical stories, like about the Garden of Eden?
Right.
Which, even if you're not religious or from the, you know, Judeo-Christian Muslim background, we still, even environmental folks will say, you know, the world was a pristine Garden of Eden until we ruined it. So you can use the sediment records from the lakes of the Holy Land to look back about 6,000 years when people would have said maybe if there was a real Eden, it would have been. And
right.
You can actually see that it was actually kind of much nicer back then. But also shows the imperfections of it and shows you that taking the idea that we're necessarily much worse than earlier humans is actually not right.
And are we seeing impacts to lakes, small and large, with respect to climate change?
Yeah. You know, the lakes of the world are responding to us not only from the people who live near it and, you know, happen to be putting pollutants in it or whatever,
mm-hmm.
adding invasive species. Those are massive changes. But even the most remote lakes are changing now, largely because of climate. And they're changing in different ways, depending on where they are, because although the global average temperature is going up, things like rainfall and wind patterns and things, they vary a lot locally. So here in the Northeast, we've gotten a lot wetter on average since the 70s,
right.
And you out in the Southwest have gotten drier on average. So a lot of our lakes here, I even remember when I was visiting some of them in the 1980s, let's say, there's a pond right near where I am right now in the Adirondacks where I used to camp on a tiny little island, and the island is underwater now. Whereas where you are, isn't your Great Salt Lake shrinking now?
And yes.
A lot of the Western lakes are shrinking. So we're hogging your water, I guess.
Right. It's gradually decreasing in size over because of a drought that we're presently in. And we're also seeing impacts to another large lake out here, Utah Lake, going back to what you're talking about, the impacts on Walden Pond with increased amounts of nutrients going into Utah Lake. And then the knock-on effects of that, of eutrophication, carp being introduced to the lake to control weeds, and then they become a nuisance. And it's just one thing after another, and eventually the lake, in effect, looks nothing like it used to look four or five decades ago.
Right. Well, this is because of the scale of this. I mean, basically, we've become a force of nature of geological scale.
Yeah.
And a lot of scientists like me are calling this a special name at this time in Earth history. We're calling it the Age of Humans, the Anthropocene Epoch.
Right.
And so as the world is changing so rapidly, we don't have enough people to even just watch what is happening, what we're losing, and what's changing. You know, professional scientists are very meticulous, you know, but a lot of times they can't work without funding, which is not always there, or there just aren't enough of them. So we really rely on citizens, too, to really pay attention to where you live and get to know your place and make yourself a world authority on your favorite lake or your favorite, you know, insect meadow, let's say, or
right.
any of those kinds of things, because the world is changing faster than we can even document it.
I was just going to ask, how do you see that role of, you know, the probably untrained citizen scientist or naturalist or somebody that's just curious about the world around them, what kind of a difference can that person make?
It's been a debate in the scientific community for a while, you know, like, can you trust the data that mere mortals collect?
Yeah.
Well, if you have somebody carefully plan the study and you ask very basic questions, there's no doubt that you can have people do this. So people who are into birds, let's say, there are breeding bird atlas surveys around the country that do a great job of monitoring, you know, where the species of birds are and are they declining or not. Unfortunately, there isn't much done with insects. So that was the big shocker that made me want to write the op-ed for the New York Times, was there was a group of mostly volunteer naturalists in Germany who monitored the just the sheer mass of insects year to year for 30 years in Germany in rural areas. And that would be something pretty much anybody could do. They didn't even bother identifying the species so much. It's just like how much insect life is there. And they found a 75% decline in the total biomass across the board of all the insects. That's something you can trust as long as it's done in a careful, consistent manner.
So how did this group in Germany become organized and get started with this?
That's an organized society. I believe it's called the Krefeld. We have something like that here, and it's hard to pronounce it. I wish they'd picked another name. I think you say Xerces, X-E-R-C-E-S,
yes.
Xerces Society.
Yeah.
And they focus on pollinators, and but they're one of the few groups that focuses on insects, which are not as charismatic, of course, as you know, birds or you know things like that. So there are organizations like that, and then other folks could pretty much do it on their own as well, especially if you hook up with a local scientist, say in a local university or college, or get high school kids in their high school biology classes to build it into the curriculum to monitor what's going on outside their classroom.
And I'll just jump in and add to that, that if people are interested in getting involved, you can contact me. You can contact the team at Swanner Eco Center, and we can help connect you with these folks,
right?
Because they're people we work with quite a bit. So in my role outside of the radio.
Well, right. Swanner does its role in educating or bringing awareness on the value of citizen science and how you can use your backyard.
Absolutely.
Like lots of famous scientists. Darwin did.
Right.
We interviewed Darwin, the gentleman who wrote the book about Darwin's backyard. He spent decades of his time studying the world in his backyard, literally. And so we can do the same.
And I'll put a call out to any educators out there, whether it's, you know, high school, middle school, or even college level. Here at Paul Smith's College, we build this right into our introductory courses.
Ah.
You know, we happen to be right here in this beautiful Adirondack Parks, but we build monitoring of plankton, insects, plants into the curriculum so that as you learn your biology, you're also contributing to a long-term database. So you don't need funding to do that, and it's a consistent thing run by the faculty, and then the students go through it and have a great context for what they're learning about.
Well, do you see businesses too, perhaps, you know, getting involved in this? Is the free market an avenue to supporting or bringing awareness on citizen science?
Well, it would depend, right? Like here in the Adirondacks, of course, fishing is very popular.
Okay.
I've been hearing from anglers, fly fishermen that say the hatches of the mayflies and things are changing and declining in some places. So there, you know, Trout Unlimited would have a vested interest, or somebody interested in, you know, birds or Natural History Museum or any of those kinds of things. Unfortunately, there are great market forces working against that, trying to sell the pesticides and things like that.
Right.
You know, develop the habitats in ways that are probably contributing to these declines.
That's a good point. But yet, there it is. There's a web, so to speak, of knowledge that's out there with these different organizations that perhaps can kind of combine their efforts to help you, Professor Stager, to get a better handle on all the information that's out there. From, like you say, from lepidopterists who who spend days a week probably studying butterflies and moths just on their own, but can go online now and share information and
right.
and help you build a greater database of knowledge.
Well, that's the positive side of this Age of Humans thing I was speaking about. We often talk about it as scientists of the damage humans have done, but most of that's been unintentional. The great thing is we're now becoming aware of ourselves as a force of nature in the Age of Humans and how empowered we are once we do connect and take advantage of this and put our ethics there to work with our brains. We can hopefully turn a lot of this around before it's too late.
And your job, too, is to maybe motivate your students to pursue a career in the natural sciences.
Well, I got to tell you, it's certainly a self-selected group here at Paul Smith College, but I am inspired daily by them and also the local high school students. I don't feel like I need to inspire them. I think this generation, as far as I can see, is wonderfully motivated, and they're sort of the first pioneers of this new age of humans that are used to being so connected and see this as their great mission to take better care of the planet than my generation did. So I feel like I just sort of try to empower them as best as I can and then get out of their way.
Well, here's an idea we always like to suggest. Get your students to host a radio show on the college campus on environmental issues.
Oh, that's a great idea.
And give them credit for that or something instead of a paper.
That's an excellent idea.
All right. If you need any help putting that together, call Nell. She'll help you.
No. Well, let's put the word out to the country. I mean, a lot of people could do that on college campuses.
That's how we got started here. Nell and I are in the environmental business. That's our full-time job as environmental scientists and environmental engineer. And we decided to do our part for the community by bringing education awareness on environmental issues. And KPCW is kind enough to give us two microphones every week to do that.
And I think we have that in common with you, don't we? You also host a radio show from time to time?
Yeah. Been doing it for 30 years.
What?
Weekly. It's called Natural Selections, and we do a little thing, a five-minute conversation every week, and then sometimes we'll do live call-ins, and that's where we actually can, the local folks will tell us how they see the world around here changing, too, that way.
And, and what radio station, how do we hear that show?
So the station is WSLU in Canton, New York. That's our public radio station. Wonderful folks. And the show is called Natural Selections. And if you type that in, and WSLU or Kurt Steger, you'll see the podcast. They go back decades.
All right. Good job, Professor Kurt Steger. He's a professor of natural sciences at Paul Smith's College and host of Natural Selections on WSLU in Canton, New York. Thank you so much. And he's got a new book called Still Waters, The Secret World of Lakes. It's just out and available at bookstores everywhere. So thank you again, Professor Steger, for joining us on This Green Earth.
Well, thank you so much for doing what you do.
Yeah.